By a Thread by Nanuchka. On Sundays, Dean does laundry. They don't go to church, obviously, so with the voices of early morning cartoons chattering in the other room, Dean gathers up what few items of clothing there are between the three of them, less when John is away on a hunt, and washes everything in the motel bathroom sink using warm water and a small amount of stolen laundry detergent. Sometimes, if there is one available, he will go to the laundromat and sit reading tattered comics or staring through the washing machine's porthole while the clothes and soap and water swirl around in a sudsy gurgle. But usually they cannot spare the quarters if they want to eat, and it is too risky to leave Sammy alone in the room while he waits for the spin cycle to finish. Sammy inevitably gets bored if he tags along or falls asleep, and then it is up to Dean to juggle both the sleeping boy and their messily folded clothes on the walk back to the room. The clothes washed in a grimy sink never feel quite clean afterwards, but Dean much prefers the false comfort of that week's motel room to the fluorescent loneliness of laundromats, the musty, stale smell of other people's clothing. While Sam watches television, reads, or naps on the couch, Dean scrubs the dirt and bloodstains from their threadbare t-shirts and jeans, rinses away the soap, and then proceeds to drape them across every available surface to dry. Once, when John came back to find everything laid out this way, he remarked that it looked like a clothing store had exploded in their room. Dean bit back the urge to point out that he hadn't seen the inside of a clothing store, one that wasn't Salvation Army at least, since his mother died, but John rarely comes back when he's expected to. If by the evening the clothing is mostly dried, Dean settles himself on the bed with his back against the headboard and a tiny sewing kit between his knees, and gets to fixing all of the rips and tears that have accumulated during the week. Sam, being 8 years old, seems to shred his t-shirts and jeans just by looking at them. John is lucky if he owns anything not torn in 15 places by claws or errant gunshots, and Dean, though less physically awkward as he leaves childhood, still can't help but catch the old sleeve or pant leg somewhere when training or going about his business. And of course there are the schoolyard fights. His family can't afford new clothes all the time, not when such a small fortune is spent on guns and rock salt on motel room bills, but Dean worries that Sammy will get teased at school if everything they own is tattered. And so, there is a surprising amount of mending to do on a weekly basis. Dean is almost certain that his dad would take him to task if he ever caught him at it, though John hasn't yet questioned him about the torn clothing that fixes itself while he's away. If anyone were to ask, Dean would vehemently insist that sewing is for girls. With their own mother dead and John not even around to make dinner most of the time, it's not as though there is anyone else to do it. At the age of 10, Dean learned how to mend tears and fix seams from a middle-aged Welshman named Evan, who approached him one evening at a laundromat somewhere in upstate New York. After watching Dean attempt to don a sock for the better part of an hour, Evan had walked over, ignoring Dean's sputtered protests, and taken the items from him one by one. "Watch," was all Evan said, before proceeding to show Dean how it was done. His aging hands were all business with a needle and thread. The Winchesters stayed in that part of town for over a month, and each Saturday, Dean would return to the laundromat to do laundry and receive another lesson, while Sammy coloured or read about dinosaurs. Evan was a stoic widower who spoke heavily accented English and never complained about having to do his own mending. It was, as he pointed out to Dean, fairly pathetic for a 60-year-old man to go around with buttons missing from his coat because he didn't know how to sew them back on. He never asked why Dean and Sammy always came to the laundromat alone, nor where their parents had gone, but sometimes he showed up, along with the extra spools of thread, with 3 peanut butter sandwiches and 3 cans of pop, which he would silently hand out before moving on to the finer points of button reinforcement. Before they left town for good, Evan had given Dean his own travel sewing kit to take with him. They never saw each other again. Now, Dean sits in companionable silence with his little brother, Sammy having graduated to books about sharks, and begins to mend. His 12-year-old fingers move clumsily, making uneven stitches, and he occasionally pricks himself on the needle with a curse. Sometimes the clothes look worse than when he began, but Dean keeps trying and is often surprised to realize how little he thinks about the wreckage of their childhood during these moments. He feels almost happy, or something very like it, and there are never buttons missing from their coats. Dean is turning a cotton t-shirt inside out when Castiel appears at the end of the bed, hunting through the fabric for small rips and tears as the television plays on a low volume across the room. The sewing kit lies open next to him, and another 3 shirts sit peddled across his outstretched legs, still slightly damp and still smelling of soap. Castiel doesn't need to breathe, but he likes how it mixes with the scent of a freshly showered Dean when he inhales. With all the other clothing scattered and draped across the motel furniture, the permeating odor of beer, takeout wrappers, and Winchester is almost overpowered by the combination of lemon scent and Irish spring. He breathes deep and smiles. When the mattress shifts under the sudden addition of his weight, Dean jerks his head up with a curse. "God damn," he barks, though with no real malice in his voice. His fingers bunch in the material of the shirt and quickly release, like they are itching to punch something, and maybe they are. But the next thing Dean does is chuckle under his breath by way of greeting. Somewhere along the line, he stopped lecturing Castiel about the personal space and sneaking up on people, as though it has become their private joke for Castiel to constantly do both of these things. "Why don't you come on in and have a seat, Cass?" he suggests with mock peevishness. "I'm already sitting," replies the angel, smile twitching. As is his wont on these little visits, Castiel removes his shoes, followed by his trench coat and suit jacket, which he folds fastidiously next to him. Castiel's time is freed up to an amazing extent since he abandoned the search for his father, even with the impending apocalypse, so he supposes that he comes often enough now to call these actions habit. Having given up on brothels and liquor store sprees, he and Dean rarely do more than talk, occasionally about the coming end of days, but oftentimes not. Sometimes, when Sam is elsewhere, they simply sit together and say nothing at all, drinking or reading or watching television in each other's presence like any of it still matters. This is Castiel's preference, the comfortable, meditative silences where words are unnecessary. He believes it is Dean's inclination as well, to be heard without having to speak. The man is both devastatingly lonely and tired of always being surrounded by others, even despite the danger of losing them the way they lost Ellen and Joe. Castiel needn't analyze too hard to realize the beginnings of loneliness in himself, too, a byproduct of being cut off from heaven, or discovering the truth about his father, or both. He doesn't miss the irony that Dean, the man who inspired his fall, is his only companion in these dark days. With Lucifer so close to total domination, it goes without saying that he may lose even this. Arranging his legs so that he is sitting Indian style no more than a foot away from Dean on the bed, Castiel leans forward to watch as Dean resumes poking through the various holes in the shirt. Occasionally he wiggles his finger through them, and as far as Castiel can tell, this only makes the tears worse. "Where is Sam?" asks Castiel, but then what he seems to be asking instead is, "Why are you alone sewing clothing in your room?" "Sam's out for a run," Dean says, gesturing at the general direction of the door with his shirt. His tone is flippant, but Castiel catches its edge. "Unless that's some euphemism for, I'm off to bend over from Lucifer that I haven't heard before. But I guess he's got to maintain that girlish figure somehow." Finding amusement in his own jokes is an area in which Dean has never struggled, but Castiel has learned that Dean appears most satisfied when Castiel himself smiles in response. "Do you not think it dangerous for him to be out on his own?" Castiel asks. Shrugging, Dean reaches over to grab the beer he has opened on the nightstand, flanked by three others already empty, and takes a swig. "Sometimes it can get just as dangerous in here," he points out. Dean offers the bottle to Castiel after taking another, longer drink. Castiel is about to decline, but thinks twice and accepts the beer instead. It is rare for Dean's drinking to be so relaxed and casual in place of the mean, punishing chugging he tends to do when he's upset, almost daily now. It's something Castiel has only seen a handful of times on their evenings together, but predisposes him to want to join in just that little bit more, especially with Dean already warm and good-humouredly tipsy. He cannot understand why it should please the humans to watch him consume alcohol, but the more intoxicated his vessel becomes, and the more Castiel insists that his mind is completely sober, the more they seem to enjoy it. He takes a drink and studies the bottle for a moment, its beads of precipitation and peeling label, before handing it back to Dean. "Is this your method of maintaining your own girlish figure?" he wonders. "Cute," says Dean. He sets the bottle down and picks up the shirt again. Talking as he works, he continues, "Nope, I'm just enjoying some quality making men time by myself. Gets some extra mileage out of the clothes before we start looking like proper vagrants, and keeps me in touch with my feminine side. I used to do all of this all the time for me and Sammy and my dad when we were growing up." Dean pauses and appears thoughtful for a moment. His eyes seem to look inward briefly before a smile crosses his lips, and he looks at Castiel with what seems like an indifferent set to his eyebrows, which Castiel correctly reads as regret. "Now I guess I just do my own." "This is an activity in which the men of your culture do not often participate," Castiel observes neutrally. The tiny sewing kit sits at Dean's right, and he picks it up for a closer look. Inside of the battered plastic case are perhaps 15 differently colored threads, tiny scissors, extra buttons, needles, safety pins. The kit is pleasingly compact. For some reason, it sends a frisson of happiness to Castiel, who has discovered a rather human fascination with miniatures. Your mother taught you these skills. You mean the manly art of stitching? No, Dean replies, taking the kit from him. I just picked it up along the way. Still couldn't use an iron if my life depended on it, though. With Castiel watching, Dean selects the white-colored thread and wets one end on his tongue, before he squints and attempts to pass it through the eye of the needle. Castiel can't help but think of camels and scripture. Dean's hands are confident and sure. He gets it on the first try. Smiling enigmatically, Dean scoffs to himself before adding, "It's a little pathetic for a grown man to go around with buttons missing from his coat because he doesn't know how to sew them back on." "This surprises me about you, Dean Winchester," is all Castiel says. He can tell from the self-depreciating jokes that Dean is insecure of how sewing reflects upon his masculinity, but, finding human gender roles arbitrary and rather cumbersome, Castiel is simply charmed, if a little baffled. Why Sam is so constantly described as the mysterious one is beyond him, when Castiel, even with the ability to read minds, is still discovering new and fascinating sides to Dean. Although he bristles at aligning his thoughts with those of the father, when Castiel looks at Dean, all he can see is a masterpiece. That he holds Dean in this regard more exclusively is what, in Dean's speak, he would call his own damage. Fallen, Castiel is able to nurture this love without distress, but has grace enough still to accept the feeling without hope or expectation. It simply is. In times past, a warrior's love for his fellow soldier was seen as his greatest strength. It is something they are both in need of in the weeks, days, to follow. He sets aside this familiar train of thought in favor of looking down at his own rumpled dress shirt, which Dean refers to as his holy tax accountant's uniform. It takes approximately 2 seconds to visually identify a number of areas in need of help from Dean's sewing kit. A button is indeed missing from the cuff, and there are a couple of rips here and there elsewhere on the shirt. The lining of his trench coat is also approaching tattered, as Castiel remembers it. He thinks that Jimmy Novak's wife probably did the mending for him while he was still alive, whereas for Cass, concern over his personal appearance has taken something of a back seat since the apocalypse started. Dean, who, much to Castiel's quiet pleasure, likes to study Castiel when he thinks he isn't looking, and sometimes even when he is, notices him taking stock of his clothing. "Considering taking up some sewing of your own, buddy?" he asks, to which Castiel affords him a rare laugh, both at the jibe and the mental image of him, an angel, bothering with needle and thread. Beaming, Dean attempts to hide his appreciation for Castiel's laugh with another swig of beer before Castiel happily takes the bottle from his hand and follows suit, draining it. By now, Dean has given up hope of accomplishing any work on his own clothing and drops the t-shirt into his lap before stabbing the threaded needle into the duvet cover. He holds out a hand for Castiel and gestures at him vaguely. "Here," he says. "Here what?" "Give me your shirt." Although he immediately understands why Dean has asked for his shirt, Castiel cocks an eyebrow, something he does a great deal of when in conversation with Dean. He's seen this look pass between the Winchesters and Bobby often, and it is one human expression he greatly enjoys. As he removes his tie and begins to unbutton the shirt, he casually asks, "This is a plot device from your favorite film, is it not?" "My favorite film?" parrots Dean. He looks up from watching Castiel's fingers to arrange his face into a mask of confusion. "You mean Spinal Tap?" "No." Pausing thoughtfully when he has finished with the last button, Castiel pretends to consider something for a moment before he says, with great deliberateness, "Casa Erotica, part 12, I believe." The television instantly switches to an adult movie channel with the volume on full blast. Cass doesn't even smirk when Dean gives a surprised start. "Have we remembered the title correctly?" To his credit, Dean flushes across his cheekbones and down his neck, but doesn't miss a beat before he dives at Castiel and wrestles him to the mattress. Beer bottles clatter noisily to the floor, knocked over by an errant foot, and the bed frame screeches in complaint. There is a tussle, and some choice words about Castiel's father from Dean, before the angel is shoved face first into the bedspread with a hand on the back of his neck. Castiel tries not to laugh, and allows the shirt to be jerked down his arms and off his body, no doubt tearing it even more in the process. "Douche move, Cass," says Dean, approvingly. He struggles onto his back under Dean using elbows, making Dean grunt, and Castiel is forced to consider the ridiculousness of two grown men, one of them half-drunk and clad only in a t-shirt and boxer briefs, the other not even really human, wrestling over a cheap piece of clothing. Cass knows the exact expression he'd find upon Uriel's face at the picture were he still alive. It makes him crow with laughter in a way he's never done, at which Dean also begins to laugh, and with the distracting sounds of slapping flesh and half-hearted moaning in the background, Angel and human giggle like children until Dean runs short of breath. Here at the end of the world, even if for a moment only, Castiel realizes that they are both incandescently happy. A few minutes pass, and Castiel remains pinned to the bed as Dean grabs at the remote and silences the television. The angel lies passive. With a sigh, Dean pushes himself up, breathing a bit heavily, levering his hands against the mattress on either side of Castiel's head. His eyes are bright, but an anxious muscle jumps in his cheek, and Castiel watches his expression flicker from contentment to uncertainty to something utterly heartbreaking. The moment has vanished as reality settles in. He can feel Dean's heartbeat race through both of their t-shirts, and without guile, Castiel places a hand on his shoulder, beneath the sleeve, feeling the ridges of his own handprint soft on Dean's skin. At this, Dean says, "Cass," very gently, and swallows. Castiel, smiling peacefully, closes his eyes and tips his head back against the mattress as he breathes a sigh. "I know," he murmurs, and turns his head to brush a kiss across the skin of Dean's forearm. There is a shiver. A moment later, Castiel feels Dean's forehead come to rest against his cheek. For a while, neither of them moves. When Dean finally does push himself back to sit on his heels, Castiel props himself on his elbows and simply looks, face solemn, as Dean struggles to compose himself with his eyes closed and his jaw clenched, one of his fists still clutching Castiel's shirt. Castiel recognizes the expression Dean gets when he is feeling the burn of tears behind his eyelids and is amazed to know that they are for him, that he has not been alone in making sacrifices. Smiling grimly when he literally shakes himself out of it, Dean half-heartedly snaps Castiel across the chest with his own shirt, using it like a whip. Castiel is supposed to smile in response, but doesn't. Instead watches Dean climb off the bed and move towards the window to stare into the darkness, hands braced against the frame. A slam crashes unexpectedly through the silence when Dean punches the wall next to the window, but he appears calm when he walks back to the bed. Taking a seat beside Cass and scrubbing a hand across his eyes, he reaches across the duvet for the needle and thread he discarded earlier. Dean puts it in his teeth while he spreads his shirt across his lap and chooses the first tear to begin working on. Sitting up, Castiel places a hand over Dean's. The shirt can be repaired with a thought, in the same way that he has healed dozens of cuts and bruises in the past, the same way he restored Dean's body after pulling him from hell. But Dean shakes his head and moves his hand away. "I want to do it," is all he says. Dean pinches the two edges of the ripped fabric together and makes the first stitch, tugging a little to ensure that the knotted end of the thread stays put. His hands are steady but unhurried, working in and out with the needle, small, tiny stitches appearing down the length of the tear that are all uniform in size. Castiel watches avidly as the fabric becomes whole again. The whole process takes about 5 minutes, maybe less, and Castiel appreciates that years of mending the clothes of the people he loves have made Dean's hands adept at this task. When Dean has made the final knot, he brings the shirt to his face to sever the thread with his teeth. Castiel sees that he is crying without noise. Unsure of anything else that could feel right at this moment, even as he knows that Dean will hate him for it, Castiel slides his hand across the back of Dean's neck and into his hair, turning the other man's head to face him. He leans in and kisses Dean gently, deeply, and thinks that if he never has more than this again for eternity, he will have enough. From the hand that bunches in his t-shirt and pulls him closer, the muffled, "Damn you, Cass," Castiel knows that Dean does not agree. He pulls away and looks Dean in the eye helplessly. Dean Winchester gazes back without blinking, eyes vivid green with misery, anger, and tears. He exhales roughly and kisses Castiel once more, says, "You're welcome."